heart and soul of a nation, beckons the call. The voice of our forefathers heard in the distance.
A house divided against itself cannot stand.
To reclaim our honor.
Our soul. The challenges of a generation call out. Future generations hang in the balance. We choose liberty. This is the voice of a nation.
The nation.
And now, Malcolm.
You know, growing up as a little boy, I grew up believing in America. I just that sense of patriotism that many of us have, I believed in America. Of course, that was in the days Ronald Reagan was in the White House. And you know, there was something about Reagan and the way he talked to the nation in that tone. And, you know, it wasn't just average patriotism. It was patriotism running through his veins. And you knew it. You knew it as an American. Reagan had a gift to be able to bring the people together in a very unique way. And so growing up as a young boy, I didn't really always see the bitter partisanship there, although it was there. I mean, remember Tip O'Neill, and they would always say, well, no matter what happened during the day, they'd go out for a drink afterward. Of course, Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the House. And it was an interesting dynamics of the political parties, but I didn't quite remember it to the level it is today. I don't think any of you did as well. And I say that, and then you say, well, I don't know, really, was it? Well, when you look at the track record over the last 3.5 years and you see what's really taken place with President Trump, there are none of us who have seen this level of vitriol and division in the nation. You know, but again, Donald Trump is one of those presidents. As far as I'm concerned, he's another patriotic president in the way of a Reagan. And you don't see that all the time. In fact, again, if you look back over the last 35, 40 years, I don't think you can say the same thing about any of the past many administrations. As far as I can see, you'd have to go all the way back to the Reagan days to see the level of patriotism that a president has, such as Donald J. Trump. I mean, the man is absolutely patriotic. And those of you out there who are patriotic, you know what I'm talking about. And you probably can relate to what I'm saying because we grew up in that era believing in America. We believed in, absolutely, the shining city in the hill. We believed that people could come together in whatever division was out there. Now, this was before the 9/11 business. This was before that division. It was certainly before the pandemics we're dealing with now. But it was also before, you know, Trump came along and, you know, upset the apple cart, before the Mueller thing, before the Russia collusion thing, before all of those scandals that have happened. Today, friends, I want to talk to you about the stakes. If you take a journey with me, I'd like to talk to you about the stakes. What's at stake with this pandemic? I'm hearing a lot of people say in my ears, well, we need to come together. We need to come together. We need to come and fight this thing as Americans. And that typically used to resonate with me, but it doesn't anymore. And I don't like saying that, but it doesn't really resonate with me anymore when say, well, we got to come together as Americans. You know, there's no more Republicans, Democrats, or socialists, or independents, or whatever. We need to come together as an American and fight this pandemic because we haven't seen anything like this in our lifetime, right? I mean, this is bigger than 9/11, they say, right? And That's the word on the street. That's the sense that the talking mouths are giving us. That's, you know, come together as a people. These are unprecedented times, and we need to fight this thing together. We need to have that level of patriotism again. So what they're asking is this. Yeah, I think if you think of it this way, they're asking for you to forget the last 3.5 years. If you would kindly, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, mom and dad at home, please forget the last 3.5 years. We need you to come together now because the stakes are miles high. And so everything that's happened, we need you to wash that away, forget about it, and let's unite to fight this evil pandemic that has gripped the nation and the world. Now, on the surface, friends, that sounds really good. And as a patriotic dude myself, I can typically get into that, but not this time. I have a real problem with trying to get into that whole come together, unify, Let's all make this happen. It's all good. When you consider what's happened over the last 3.5 years, the spying that has gone on, the FISA courts, the false documents for investigations, the countless confidential documents that are leaked to the media, those that have been falsely accused, and of course, appointed prosecutors, special counsels, investigations, spending tens of hundreds of millions of dollars, all with the idea that Donald J. Trump was guilty of something. And we know he is. We will find it, I assure you. That's been the talking point from the left from day one. And so now, how do you forget all of that over these last many years? How do we sweep that away? So I started thinking, I'm kind of easy when it comes to America. When it comes to patriotism, when it comes to America, I am easy. That's the one thing. I'll lay down my life and my arm for the country. I'm easy. You understand? I'm not a hard ass when it comes to this country. Yeah. I mean, I'll put it all out there for you. Absolutely. I get it. I understand the gift that we have here, the gift of life and the gift of America, 100%. So I started thinking almost, well, maybe there's something to this. And maybe, just maybe, they are going to come together. And every so often you've seen little glimmers of that, little glimmers. But then you know that the partisanship comes out. As soon as the opportunity is there, whether it's a governor or a mayor that's on the opposing side, or certainly the minority leader, right? You'll see that come out immediately. And then you kind of know again, and you say, well, I don't know about that patriotism, how that's going to work really. Well, then what happened is I got an email in. And I get these emails in from different organizations so that I'm in the know. And I get them from the left all the time because I subscribe to those kinds of things. I want to know what they're saying. I want to know what they're talking about. I want to know what they're thinking and what they send to their constituents. And so I get these in. And this one came from Politico into my email box. I thought, okay, let's see how we're going to unite the country now. Let's take a look at this because the stakes are high, remember. The stakes are sky high. And so I start to look at the email, and it goes on to say, the conventional wisdom is that President Donald Trump's uneven and at times chaotic handling of the crisis is deeply problematic for his reelection chances, but it may not be that simple, friends. Yeah, Trump's taking a beating. Economy's tanking. That's just what they wanted, the economy to sink, the recession to grip the nation. That was their wish. That was their hope. Their Hail Mary, as I said. And so the economy tanking, and just 46% of Americans, the email goes on to say, believe that the federal government is doing enough to confront the coronavirus. That's down from 61% last month, it said. And this was a new poll out, and few people trust that Trump is saying what he's saying about the pandemic. That they simply don't trust him. They're saying that's what this poll says. They're putting out there, And it goes on to say with the coronavirus spreading early in the election cycle, and that also, by the way, is the most unprecedented. I was saying to you yesterday, it's bad enough we have a pandemic, but in an election year, is the timing of all this could not make up. I mean, this is beyond the beyond that it's happening now. Why primary and elections are going on in a general election year that we're fighting this catastrophe, this pandemic, So again, it says with the coronavirus spreading early in the election cycle, this week, the Republican president adopted a more somber tone, more what they wanted presidential. You've been hearing that for years now. When's he going to be presidential? That president isn't presidential. He's on Twitter not being presidential. You have a certain code of ethics. You have to be here and be presidential. Got to do it a certain way because the establishment says you have to do it a certain way. And if you're not, well, then you are a racist and a xenophobe and a mentally challenged person. We'll need to, get you out of there. You can't handle the office, right? And so it says the Republican president adopted a more somber tone, and Democrats are beginning to worry. They're beginning to worry, Politico says, that he could mold the narrative to his benefit. Oh, my God. How dear the president benefit by rising above this and, you know, fixing it and helping Americans out? I mean, why would he do that? Why would this standoffish president who doesn't give a rat's ass about anything, this xenophobe, racist SOB, why would he do that all of a sudden? This guy who's not certainly not patriotic, right? The left would say, doesn't believe in America. Well, Politico says a massive stimulus, including direct payments to Americans, could help him in November. And that this man's going to give money to Americans? What is the matter with him? That's our job. That's what the left is saying. That's our job. Not a Republican president, not a conservative. Come on. These guys don't have any heart. Obviously, the president is deranged at the moment, even more than normal, that he would even consider such a thing, huh? Well, Politico says, but history tells us that an incumbent who steers us through a challenging time, a la Bush and 9/11 and Obama and the Great Recession, are rewarded with a second term. And there's the gasp in the room. You can hear them in the back of the room. Oh, my God, don't tell me. He might navigate this thing properly, and we might be okay. And that's not good. This is the crisis we got to use to get him out. It's the Hail Mary we need, you know? And so it ends up saying this. The president didn't handle the response well in the opening weeks, Politico says. But if the pandemic abates and the economy stabilizes by the fall, well, then we see a scenario in which Trump comes out of the crisis framing it as an American comeback story. How dare he, huh? And positioning himself as the leader, the president, who navigated the country through a crisis. Wow. So I got that email in just in the nick of time, people. Because I was almost getting soft and thinking, well, you know, they're going to come together. They almost had me. I'm telling you, I was really, really close. They almost had me believing that we were going to unite. And I thought, now what am I going to, I'm going to have to do my part. I'm going to have to get on here and, you know, unite the people here, which is, of course, what I love to do. You know, but then they always, you know, stick something in your back. You always feel a sharp object coming in your back somehow, and it gets uncomfortable, you see. And so I want to thank today here at Politico in a big way for sending that email out. And I want to send them my blessings and heartfelt thank you for reminding us and reminding conservatives that we cannot trust those who have other means and another agenda. We must continue on with the journey of the out loud truth, and we must frame this in the way it needs to be framed. Yes, unite as conservative Americans and as patriots, absolutely. And honor our Constitution, absolutely. Bring the framers' vision of a great America forward, absolutely. Protect America at all costs, absolutely. But don't let your guard down for a moment, because the left, the Democrat Socialist Party of America, has another agenda. And they're pulling it over your eyes. So today I want to talk about the stakes that are at play, and how we, in a general election year, how we navigate this all forward. We'll do that with Michael Johns. I look forward to having him on and getting him to opine on all of this. But that's the story today, friends, on The Voice of the Nation. It's your news and entertainment network. News blogs, informative podcasts, entertaining videos, or listen to 24/7 talk radio on our free apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa. We the People, AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Do Did you know the average person spends 26 years of their life sleeping? The real troubling statistic is that we spend 7 years of our life trying to get to sleep, struggling with racing minds, tossing and turning. If you're one of the millions of Americans who need better quality sleep, the time to change is now. Sleep is proven to extend our lifespan, protect against terrible diseases like cancer, heart disease, and dementia, make us more attractive and thinner, feel calmer and happier, and boost energy levels, memory, and performance. Until now, most sleep supplements haven't worked, but a new, easy-to-swallow sleep gel, invented by the leading nutrition company, Healthy Cell, is designed to support all four stages of human sleep to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake up refreshed. It's called REM Sleep. To get a free two-night supply of REM sleep, visit healthycell.com/sleep. That's healthy, CELL.com/sleep.
Our global experts are brilliant writers and engaging hosts on a mission of a lifetime. You'll find the latest news and inspiration on the front page of AmericaOutloud.com.
Politico says the president didn't handle the response well in the opening weeks, but if the pandemic abates and the economy stabilizes by the fall, well, we see a scenario in which Trump comes out of the crisis framing it as an American comeback story and positioning himself as the leader who navigated the country through a crisis. Well, joining me now, Michael Johns is the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement, a former White House speechwriter and a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Always, as you do, love having Michael's voice on the platform and try to bring some sense to the sometimes, the insensible that we can't make sense of. But so, Michael, I read you that. I was almost convinced that we were going to unite somehow and pull this off as Americans. And I started thinking back again to my Reagan days. And then I realized that it was all just sort of a bad dream with that email, which they actually did me a favor because they reminded me exactly in that weak moment of really putting America first, which I always do, of what the stakes were. But I don't think they're changing, Michael. Do you?
I think over the last week to 10 days, I have sensed that, and I'll tell you, having worked in both the legislative, in Congress and in the White House, that as much as polls are pretty uniformly discarded publicly, privately, they're consumed with great degrees of interest, that the message that is getting to Washington, both the administration and to Congress, and particularly Democrats in Congress, is that there's not a lot of patience for any politicization of this crisis. And I've started to notice some degree of restraint that I think is beginning to come into the rhetoric. I mean, you look at the third stimulus package now that has come together. These are multi-billion-dollar spending packages over which there would be typically abundant areas of discord and conflict and disagreement. And they're coming together pretty quickly. Also, you know, I think you saw some early attempts, particularly by the media, to really misrepresent the Trump administration's generally very good leadership on this to date. And those didn't really catch a lot of traction and subsequently have been debunked. And then you go through what the president's actually done and say, well, bad leadership? Where's this bad leadership? I mean, the first logical thing he did was cut off travel from the affected regions of
which
the world.
They complained about.
Yeah, which they opposed, actually. So it's worth, you know, speculating and hopefully doing it in a, you know, a clinical way. What would the effect have been, for instance, had the president of the United States not suspended travel from China in the early days of this pandemic? What would the effect have been if he hadn't suspended it from those who had visited Iran, where this is also very prevalent, or from South Korea, or more recently from Europe, where it's taken a very strong grip? Mm-hmm. So that was the first and logical step that he took. And to me, that's an entirely constructive initiative. And as you correctly point out, it was nothing but criticized by Democrats. Mm-hmm. Then you get into the economic assistance packages. I mean, a
strong focus on the effect this was going to have on small businesses, expanded the loan opportunities by $50 billion to small businesses that are affected by it. He's taken steps to expand medical and family leave by those who are affected by it. He's had the Department of Treasury to suspend tax collections for affected entities. He's proposed the payroll tax cut, which I think is a fantastic idea, hasn't yet really been universally embraced by Congress. He's declared a national disaster, obviously, which affords the executive branch some degree of flexibility and additional powers that they wouldn't otherwise be given, and quickly passed $8 billion spending package that came through Congress in support for public health initiatives on the federal and state level. All of those, you know, I think, logical responses that you would see from this. Then I guess finally, you know, we brought together last week a good number of private sector leaders in the White House press conference, showing his ability to coordinate all of the affected and influential parties that are they're going to be essential, really, to being able to treat, manage, and minimize the magnitude of this crisis. So his leadership, I think, has been pretty exceptional.
Well, he's done just what a good CEO would do. You bring the powers to be into the room. I like that about Donald Trump. He goes right to the source, brings them into the room, and deals with it just as a CEO would. And I know how that works because I was a CEO for 25 years, and I understand what the stakes are when you are a CEO, a chief executive officer, and you have to make those decisions. And typically you rely on those executives and the brilliant people around you if you've surrounded yourself with the right people. Here's the thing with Donald Trump. You know, would you agree with this statement, Michael, is that Donald Trump does, when you look at everything you just played out with the potential stimulus dollars and the budgets and, you know, all the different things we're talking about, which you say could be very controversial under any normal condition, which this is not. But safe to say, this president, when you look at his record, in a very interesting way, you know, he doesn't really play to Republican talking points any more than he does the Democrat talking points. The way I see it, he really plays more to America's talking points. I mean, some people call him a populist president, of course, but he really plays, I think, at the end of the day, my guess with Donald Trump, Michael, is he's going to do what he thinks is best for Americans, regardless of political party. You agree with that statement?
Yeah, I do. It's one of the reasons that I endorsed him on day one of his candidacy back in 2015. I think he has underlying foundational beliefs in the traditional tenets of conservatism. But unlike some political leaders, I don't think he's blindly loyal to it. I think he's cognizant of the fact that it takes a hybrid approach really to be able to successfully lead this country. And this is a perfect example of it. So for instance, if you were a libertarian, you know, who had a laissez-faire approach toward the economy and felt that all of this could be done without any government intervention, you know, that's utterly unrealistic. I don't think there's really too many Americans who would put any credence on that. In that, conversely, if you were a, you know, a big government socialist who believed that government and government alone can solve all these problems, you're equally delusional. I mean, this is going to require a great degree of cooperation with our private sector biopharmaceutical companies, with healthcare delivery systems, with private practitioners of medicine, with testing labs, with, you know, the mega healthcare stores that he had there, you know, Target, Walmart, CVS, others. I think it his approach to it is both practical and logical. And I think the American people, by and large, embrace that. And I would say, to the extent that polls still matter, and 2020 after the 2016 election.
Yeah.
If you look at the support, if you look for the support of the president, you know, let's take the Rasmussen poll I was just looking at from a few days ago. I mean, he's at 46% support still among American voters, 33% of which is strong support. That's more or less very much in line with where he's been since the beginning of this presidency. So I think the instinct is that if you generally have been supportive of this president to date, you're pretty satisfied with the way he's handling this. If you are looking for some areas to criticize this president, you might buy into a handful of the misrepresentations and outright lies and fabrications that have been put forward by the media about his leadership. A few of which I just started writing down here.
Yeah, you so get it.
It's quite amazing.
Yeah, no, I tell you, I learn from you every time you're on, and you so get it when you talk about this, because I love the way you just said blindly loyal versus a hybrid approach. And that is one of the big attractions of this president, I think, that should not be lost on anybody. And that's a beautiful thing, what Michael just put out there, in fact. The fact that this president is not blindly loyal. He's really not. He's really an intellect that looks at the problem from a different way. You got to look at a problem all different ways, 360 degrees, to really find the right answer. And I like the way this president does that via what you call it, Michael, a hybrid approach, is a perfect, awesome way to put that. That's important right now, because the playbook of what it's been, Michael, is not going to solve the problem, as you just said. It's not going to solve the problem at all. You got to get way out of the box on this one, because this is a heavy lift, right?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, you look at it, and I think everyone's looking at it right now from the standpoint of, you know, the public wellness of the country and the economic health of the country. But ultimately, beneath it all, let's be honest, are political considerations, an administration that wants four more years, and a opposition party that is, as you correctly said at the outset, done just about anything and everything to remove them. Now this arises, it's certainly a curveball no one anticipated several months ago, at least at this magnitude. And I think the message that's being sent nationally is one of an expectation of cooperation and collaboration. So you can't, as a Democrat, go back to a district asking for two more years in the House or six more years if you're in the Senate, saying, I stopped Trump's bad initiatives to solve the coronavirus. Didn't pass anything, didn't get anything done, but we stopped the bad ideas. Now, the American people are expecting real action here. And every assessment of this crisis suggests that it is going to be a significant one. And that's unfortunate.
You say another very interesting thing a moment ago about restraint. And you said that you've noticed the restraint, back to the partisan politics and what's been happening over the last couple of weeks, you say, they've sort of started to dial it back. Well, they've had to do that because of, you know, again, framing this whole thing up. I mean, this is beyond a curveball. This is a curveball, slider, spitball, fastball, all in one. I mean, this is a massive undertaking. As I said a moment ago, it's a heavy lift. And that's why this president is moving in the way that he's doing, with as many experts that he's doing it with. But when you say restraint, see, that's a good word for people to really digest that a moment, because what they're doing, so the question really becomes, Michael, when do they lose that restraint? In other words, they're going to have that restraint up to a point. In other words, the gloves are going to come off and that restraint will be gone as soon as they realize that, okay, the president, back to what Politico said a moment ago, that, oh my God, the president may have a comeback story, and he positioned himself as the leader who navigated the country through a crisis. Oh my God. And then we, what do they say? Never let a crisis go to waste, Michael?
Yeah, of course. And that's been a sort of standard operating approach that the far left has used. But, and I think initially that was the instinct here, was to try to leverage this for political purposes. The answer to your question ultimately is, if you sort of operate on the assumption that I think most people are, that this is going to escalate, and then at some point, yet to be determined, it's going to de-escalate, and that how far it escalates is very much a question at this point, it's ostensibly dependent upon the steps that are and are not taken within this country. That's the point where I think you'll begin to see retrospective commentary about Trump's leadership. But right now, the American people have, I think, seemingly no patience to hear any of that. And I just went through, like, you know, there's a few, like, I think this is interesting, and I'm sure I've missed some here, but I was just thinking you have the media that incorrectly presented that Trump ordered the governors to go get your own ventilators, and then, you know, the transcript of that call comes out, and no, that's not at all what he said. He said he encouraged them, if they had opportunities, to go get them, to do that, but he had the full backing of the federal government in support of that. There was this totally contrived line that he was seeking some sort of monopoly on the vaccine, which just shows a complete lack of understanding about how our FDA process works, or even how biopharmaceutical development works. That never happened. You had the rumor of the nationwide curfew, immediately debunked by the administration, not under consideration, no real solid sources for where that emerged. Mm-hmm. The Google issue, where, you know, he came out in the White House Rose Garden press conference and said that Google was working with the administration in the development of a coronavirus resource website nationally that would be, you know, augment some of the federal and other initiatives that were taken.
What became of that story with that Google?
Immediately you had to, like, some Google sources that said, no, we're only doing a test experiment.
Yeah, I've seen that.
In the Bay Area of San Francisco. But then, you know, like, several hours later, the company said, we actually, you know, at the appropriate levels, we have been in discussion with the administration. We are working on this.
See, I didn't hear that, Michael. That's why I asked you. I didn't hear that. Like always, I heard the big talking points up front that he lied and Google is not doing it, but I never heard the other part of what you just said.
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, Google, issued corporate-level statements, which is where this should have come from to begin with, you know, saying absolutely what the president said is completely correct. Mm-hmm. And we are in this degree of partnership with the administration creating this resource.
Yeah.
One of the biggest lies that the Trump disbanded the pandemic office, which of course, if you know anything about the federal government, there's no singular pandemic office. You know, these operate throughout the federal government. CDC has a lot of resources. Health and Human Services has a lot of resources. CMS, which manages Medicare and Medicaid, has a lot of resources. FEMA has resources. And then there's this National Security Council in the White House that has resources as well. Well, it turns out that, you know, the person who had written this op-ed, who had worked in that office in the NSC in the White House, who was when I looked into the background of the person, a Ted Kennedy Democrat appointee from the Obama administration, who had been removed from the administration, had said that the entire office had been disbanded. And, you know, the individual who subsequently took over the leadership, guy now with the Hudson Institute, came out with a subsequent office, and the office wasn't disbanded at all, mm-hmm. you know, and that it continues in functionality and it's still around. So that was misleading.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you had this lie that the president somehow said this thing was a hoax, mm-hmm. which, of course, he never said. I think he's tempered the balancing act between both responding assertively and appropriately and aggressively to this real threat without alarming the American people. And I think that's very difficult for some of the media and some, you know, who are
without
critical
alarming
of the president to sort of understand this balancing act.
Yeah.
That you neither want to overreact nor underreact.
And that's so, the fine line.
It is a fine line. You don't want to terrify the American people.
That's right.
And yet you don't want to leave the American people in the dark that there's logical steps that they can be doing to protect themselves. And so has there been an evolution in the rhetoric of the president from the beginning of this, when we had a handful of cases that were exclusively in essentially Washington State, much of which came from one specific nursing home? Of course there has. Mm-hmm. There would have been with any president.
Right.
You know, the magnitude of the threat has escalated, and as the magnitude of the threat has become more real and more apparent, you've seen the seriousness of the administration's response ahead of that curve, I believe. And I think, you know, you still, even utilizing these numbers that are provided by these countries whose health data I don't particularly trust, particularly China and Iran, you look at this in a proportionate way with where we stand in relationship to the rest of the world. You know, in a comparative way, we're doing vastly better than China, vastly better than Italy, vastly better than Iran. In both the number of cases that are emerging, but also in the number of deaths from it, which I suppose is ultimately the real number that you want to contain.
Yeah, and of course, the jury's out with all of it because we're in the midst of this pandemic now. But all of the examples you just gave out there right now are examples of where, Michael, I think you begin to question, okay, like how long will they have this restraint for? And every so often they lose their grip and they forget. And then, as you say, you gave some great examples there, all from like the Google and then all these other examples back and forth. But, you know, when the president started off, he was optimistic. He is the chief cheerleader of the nation. He's supposed to pick and lift Americans up. And he was accused of not taking it seriously and being too optimistic. And, you know, by saying, well, no, I think we're going to be fine. And they accused the president right at that point of being a buffoon and not really understanding the seriousness of the problem or leveling with the American
people. But importantly, as you pointed out before, they did that while simultaneously criticizing the one step that he did take, which was to cut off travel from from the singular biggest source of this pandemic. So the assertive step that he took, putting in travel restrictions against the second largest economy in the world, is no small step. That's a very significant step.
Yeah.
And if had he not taken that step, and I believe, frankly, you know, Joe Biden, if he had been president, or many of these Democrats who seemingly don't believe in any travel restrictions, sometimes don't even believe in borders.
That's right.
We would likely not have taken that. We might be dealing with, as opposed to 5,000 plus cases right now, 50,000 plus
cases. That's right. Or more.
Or 100,000 plus cases.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. That is a great point. And we'll talk more about that primary ahead as well with Biden and Sanders. But that is a very, very valid point you make here. And it really is. You hear Michael, their friends, talk about the restraint. And you wonder, like, you know, and I do wonder how long they'll remain with that restraint, because they are trying to do that. And I think Michael puts it out there so well when he says, well, you know, the American people do not have patience for this. And I think he's absolutely right. I think all of these will play to the president's position no matter what, because, you know, the American people are not stupid. I mean, and none of them are. Even the left isn't stupid. And certainly moderates and independents are bright people just looking for the best for America. And those are the people we need to get to here. So let me take a moment to remind you to invite your independents and your moderates into the program here at A Voice of a Nation on America Out Loud Talk Radio. Those are the people we want to reach, friends. We want to reach the people in the middle of the aisle and the independents and the communists and socialists are probably not going to be interested in this patriotic American program, and we're okay with that. But it is the moderates and the independents we are trying to attract to the network, and I encourage you to share and to invite those people in, please, to an optimistic word and a view more of what the America we see, the original America, the America that worked for 243 years. That's the America we're trying to preserve here. Friends, it's all back at AmericaOutLoud.com. We have, again, bloggers, writers, columnists from around the globe. Our show hosts, everything on talk radio or podcast thereafter, it's all available there. Our apps on Apple, Android, or Alexa are all available there. We are a grassroots movement of patriots who passionately love this country. And I guess the biggest thing you could say is the level of talent we have on the platform. I'm reminded of every day, because people point it out to me every day, do you realize the talent you have? And I gratefully do realize that. And I grin from ear to ear when they say it. So it's a beautiful reminder to hear that. You can always email us here at liberty@AmericaOutLoud.com. So I want to talk about the media next, talk about the primary, the election, and we got the awesome Michael Johns on. More on that in just a moment. spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. Now you see that Biden, just the last few days here, is sweeping up in the primaries, swept Florida, swept a lot of other states, and he is sweeping through these primaries left and right, and he is obviously now going to be. In fact, he has now just been appointed Secret Service for Joe Biden. A lot of Americans may not know that, but that's when things get serious and they think you are definitely going to be the candidate to run for the highest office in the land, and then you get Secret Service. That was just appointed to him as well.
Yeah, I think when you and I last spoke, I said I thought that this March 15th, last Sunday evening debate was crucial for him, and that he had to go after Biden's obvious many weak points, including his support for the Iraq war, including his previous and repeated embrace of cuts for Social Security. Especially his likely personal family areas of conflict and corruption as it relates to Hunter Biden's presence on the Ukrainian energy board company and the investments he's received from China into the hundreds of millions of dollars. And he brought up the first two items really very lightly and briefly, and the third one as it relates to Biden's family sort of enterprise that's been developed around his political engagement, he didn't bring up at all. So it reminded me, it was like 2016 all over again. I felt the same way then, that if he had gone after Hillary Clinton on some of the ethics issues and that I think were legitimate, like areas of real concern, might have been really primary reasons why she wasn't elected president.
Yeah, those people, those Americans have been jeopardized their votes. I mean, some of those people will probably stay home. They probably won't come and support the party. And who knows, Trump may get some of those people potentially.
Michael,
especially with the job he's doing here, it's really anybody's guess right now, but that could very well happen.
Well, there's a strong case to be made for that. I mean, like, so for instance, right, if you're concerned about foreign entanglements and nation building abroad, and you were skeptical of the Iraq war, you know, Biden supported the Iraq war, but Biden's never, to my knowledge, really even apologized for that vote or rethought it. Here you have a president who's taken really proactive steps to get us out of that region. Trump's running on a Republican platform and a position of not cutting Social Security or Medicare.
That's right.
Why would, Biden has a whole 30-year history of rhetoric surrounding his interest in doing those things. So I think it really presents an unusual divide between these two parties, since some of those issues have been albatrosses around Republicans in past elections and aren't this time.
Michael, when the primary season started and the Democrats had, 25, 26? Well, I don't know what the numbers are, mid-20s somewhere, right? But people, candidates running for the...
Couple bakers, dozens.
Yeah, exactly. When that started at all, I have to be truthful with you and say to you that I would not have guessed that Joe Biden would have been where they landed. I never would have guessed this because he's such baggage that you just pointed out. But even beyond the baggage, the man clearly has, and I respectfully say this, he clearly has a case of dementia. I mean, it is obvious to everybody, including his family and his wife. And quite frankly, I will say to you this, Michael, I think it is shameful of his family, and I'm going to say this to you, his wife and his family, it is shameful that they have put him in this position and have encouraged him to run when they know full well, and I'm not being a partisan or smart guy here, they know full well he cannot do this job. There is no way in heaven's good grace and glory that he can do this job. Now, you disagree with that?
Well, no, because I think if you go back and look at 2016, there was a lot of sort of questions about it, and then ultimately not a lot of seriousness on his end. And this time too, remember, there was a lot of procrastination about whether or not he would get in. He didn't exactly jump with enthusiasm into this race. He was looking at it, thinking about it. You know, I think months went by while he was, you know, evaluating that. And you have to say, for a guy who held the second highest office in the land, whose name recognition is nearly 100%, who's dedicated his life to this, what are you thinking about? You know, and so maybe that was it. Maybe that was it. It's also obviously a big undertaking, and he's done it before, and he's never fared well. You know, it's important to point out in his previous campaigns, mm-hmm. never gotten over 10% of the support.
Yeah, he's a multi-loser. And, you know, he's been a loser every time he's done it.
I think you're onto something, because I don't see how you can look mm-hmm. at this campaign of Joe Biden's with the 20 plus candidates that existed at the beginning and say, well, yeah, obviously he's the logical person.
He was best in class or something, you know,
because it was arguably the weakest campaign
exactly.
of all of those candidates. It was filled with misstatements. I'm not sure I could define really what he is running on or standing for or what his agenda or issue is. He, you know, he's opposed many of the positions of the radical far left.
They run on the fact that Trump sucks. That's their campaign. That's been the whole left, that Trump is no good. That's what they run on. That's what their whole left runs on. Do you, with all those candidates now with Biden, let's talk about the moderates, those middle independents, the moderates, even the Democrats who still have a brain left, who are not trying to, you know, send their party to a Marxist agenda and to a socialist, Marxist, communist. I just can't believe we're talking about this stuff anymore. It befuddles my mind here. But so what do you think on that? Do you think these people are going to, I mean, you don't think, I don't think, do you think they're going to vote for Joe Biden, a guy who they know cannot handle? I mean, even if they don't really like Trump's temperament or personality or Twitter feed or whatever the hell they don't like about him, I don't think they want to be able to vote for Biden. I think those people, if they don't vote for Trump, I think a lot of those people are going to stay home.
I don't think that thus far, presuming there's no radical shift in issues that we confront, which of course there could be, mm-hmm. or perceptions of the president, which of course there could be, or, you know, issues as it relates to Biden's attractability, that he is going to be a particularly motivating force or factor that they need. I just don't see him bringing the level of energy, coherent policy agenda, and enthusiasm that I think the president will bring. And I agree with basically the conclusion of the Politico piece you cited at the beginning, mm-hmm. is that if the president navigates us successfully mm-hmm. through this, and I guess success is a subjective word, because we're going to pay a price, even in the best case of circumstances, a serious yes, one. Yeah. But even if he is perceived to have navigated us pretty smoothly through this and contained the damage best that he could as a president of the United States, I do think it reminds me of when George H.W. Bush's popularity went over 90% after mm-hmm. the quick liberation of Kuwait. It reminds me, you know, to a certain extent, the support that W had 43 after 9/11 and his rapid and assertive steps there. I think the thesis is generally correct that the American people are inclined to reward solid leadership. And I don't see how anyone's going to look at this crisis and say this was Donald Trump's creation or Donald Trump had anything to do with it. It's not an American creation. It is, as the president correctly pointed out, a foreign virus that in the best of circumstances should never have emerged at all.
Well, let's talk about that now. He's actually calling it a Chinese virus, and it's sending the Chinese over the moon on this. The president puts out a tweet here in the last day or so. He says, for the people that are now out of work because of the important and necessary containment policies, for instance, the shutting down of hotels, bars, and restaurants, money will soon be coming to you. That's, of course, the packages they're putting forth there. He continues on and says, the onslaught of the Chinese virus is not your fault. We'll be stronger than ever. And he put that tweet out, Michael, and he put another one out that said, I will be having a news conference today to discuss very important news from the FDA concerning the Chinese virus. And these were put out the other day, but the point is, I'm pointing out that there were some media stories prior to that, that the president is being his typical xenophobic self, and the Chinese ran some things that they're offended, that the president is calling it that, and pointing out where it comes from, which is really the geographical place of where it initially comes from, is Wuhan. So what do you say about the president? Is he rubbing their nose in it, or is this the proper way for the president to remind the world and the Chinese that is this the right way to go?
Yeah, there's nothing xenophobic about describing the virus in terms of where it originated. There's lots of history on that. You could go through half a dozen easily major global diseases that were named after their points of origin. In the late 1990s, I worked in an office building that was home to the Legionnaire's disease in the late 1960s, which was which came about from an American Legion gathering in that office, in that building in the late 60s. I've never heard any member of the American Legion say, don't call it the Legionnaire's disease, it offends us. It describes it. This was beyond any dispute, any doubt, a pandemic that began in Wuhan, may or may not have developed under circumstances that were avoidable or were not avoidable. But I don't see how you look at China's behavior through this whole thing and be anything but extremely, at the very least, disappointed, if not even disgusted. Mm-hmm. They clearly kept the wraps on this for at least a month when that information available to the world about the presence of this could have really been time well utilized in containing it. They have, again, these magical disappearances of people who've been out speaking the truth in China about what they've witnessed with the disease that undermines the government, the Communist Party government's official talking points on it. These people just disappear, as has historically been the case in this, human rights abusing country. And then most recently, earlier this week, they kick out a good number of American journalists from some of the most well-established and prominent American media outlets, including New York Times, Wall Street Journal. And these, I've read a lot of the stories that have come out of these reporters. I mean, they've been balanced and yet probing. They've been exactly the sort of journalism that you would expect to see out of good journalism in China. So now at precisely the moment we need to be understanding more about the origin of the virus, about what China did do, what they didn't do. We've diminished journalistic presence in that very closed country. So I think China has really done really all the worst things. They kept the CDC out of China in the early parts of this, which could have been also decisive. They have not, I don't think, and now I think they're likely misrepresenting the magnitude of improvement.
Well, they are.
Made there.
They are. And do you
it's
think
it's tough that, to say? I mean, well, it's tough to say. I don't, there's been some Americans who've been to Wuhan who said, yeah, it actually has improved over the last few months. That, if true, is certainly a reason for us to be a tad bit more optimistic about our own ability to contain this and to make sure it's, something that spans months.
It's a guessing game. It's a guessing game. We really don't know what China is doing.
You don't know. And it's, the two of the biggest countries, in the world that have been affected by this, Iran and China, are some are two of the most closed societies in the world. So I'm not at all.
Let me ask you a loaded question.
Even in the statistics, are being cited about their mortality rates and the number of affected. China, as I've said repeatedly, and certainly throughout this administration, is a real and present danger to the United States of America. It is, in my view, the single greatest national security and geoeconomic threat that we face in the world. I don't think want to see this president secure another 4 years.
They came out just last week. Did you see that? And they said that they support Joe Biden for president. He's the perfect guy for them for president.
Right, because he's not going to let them take, expand their presence and take over the South China Sea. He's not going to put in, he's not going to stand up for American commerce or industry in our trade relationships. He has an 8-year track record that we can look at where our trade deficit under his leadership went through the sky. I mean, it blossomed incredibly. China's geostrategic engagement, their theft of intellectual property, all these things expanded on Joe Biden's watch. So why would you not want that?
Well, that's what I said actually to folks just 2 days ago on air, is that, listen, these guys, Bernie Sanders has been in the Senate and Joe Biden, they've been in politics, these two cats. I mean, where were they 30, 40 years ago when China was...
That's what's really... Absolutely. I think I listened carefully to that debate and I said, I guess neither one of them could turn to the other because they've both been in there just about the same amount of time. But when you've spent your entire life in elected political office in Washington, D.C., and you're going to sit there and criticize a president who's been there for 3 years, isn't the logical pushback to sort of say, you've been here for 40 years. What did you ever do?
Exactly. People need to understand that point you're speaking about right there, because if they don't understand that, Michael, then all bets are off if they're really buying the lies and the deceits here. Friends, you're listening here to the voice of Michael Johns, and what a great program today in talking about all of this. So much more with the media and the China connection into all of this, as Michael appropriately puts it there. China is 1,000%, you can take this to the bank, people. They are the biggest, single largest threat to America, bar none. This whole notion that it was Russia was garbage, and I told you that over the last several years. It was never Russia. We should have been at the table with Russia. We need Russia to be on this side of the program. There's a lot more to that story as well. But anyways, you get the picture here. Well, the stakes are high, so I'm here to report to you the stakes are sky high. And don't forget that Politico email and the partisan politics of where we're at. Don't take your eyes off the ball for a moment, and don't trust everything you read and everything you see and everything you watch. And also, please turn the dial off of that television good part of the time. I mean, be informed, but don't sit there and let that stuff penetrate into your brain 24/7, please. No matter what you're watching, what channel it is, this 24/7 incessant drumbeat from the media is a virus in itself, and it will screw us all up. So please remember that. Take a hike. Take your family. I don't mean take a hike in a bad way. I'm talking take a hike. Take the family out. I did that with my two teenagers. Take them for a smoothie. Just do simple things. Take a walk through the park. Enjoy. Be blessed, people. Always be blessed. Thank you for being part of this journey here. It's time to get involved and get loud.